Welcome to installment 322 of Sefer Mitzvahs from the Rambam. Today's portion contains one commandment, positive commandment 179, that relating to the intensive questioning of a witness by the court, known as Chkira Udrisha, and governs when and how such questioning is applied. This commandment derives from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 13, verse 15, which discusses an Ir Nidachas, a city in which the majority of members have become idol worshippers, the penalty for which is death. In discussing the investigation of the witnesses who say that idol worship has spread throughout the city, the verse says, V'darashta, that you should investigate, V'chakarta, you should probe, V'sho'alta, heitev, and you should question very well, V'hine emes nochen adover, and if it happens to be true, then the Torah says what the punishment should be, that they should be killed by the sword. We learn from this that in general when witnesses are questioned, we must question them very closely before we can inflict a punishment and even decide the judgment. And as the Rambam says in Sefer HaMitzvahs, we must be as careful as we can in the questioning to ensure that we, referring to the judges, do not decide based on their first impression of the situation and not quickly reach a decision. Because in doing so, through being too quick, perhaps we will end up declaring an innocent person guilty. Through lengthy questioning, we will ensure that the person under accusation will be definitely guilty before inflicting a guilty verdict. The Talmudic tractate Sanhedrin discusses this law in length and all of the details regarding it. What is considered chakira? What is considered drisha? How we are supposed to be specific in its laws, and when, according to certain types of contradiction between the witnesses or unclarity among the testimony of the witnesses, when it is that their testimony remains true and intact, and when it is that we invalidate their testimony. The basic idea behind the questions referred to in Chkira Udrisha revolves around another law, which we will be learning, God willing, in another few days, the law of Edim Zemimim. The law is, if we have two sets of witnesses whose testimony contradicts each other, one testifies, for example, that they were there and saw Reuven did the murder. Another was there and says that they saw Reuven, and Reuven definitely did not do the murder. These two witnesses merely cancel each other out. However, let's say the first set of witnesses say, we saw Reuven do it. And a second set of witnesses come along and say, how can you testify? We don't know whether Reuven did it or not, but we do know that at the time the murder occurred, you were with us in another place. These are called Edim Zemimin, and as we will learn, their testimony takes precedence over the first. And as we shall see, whatever punishment they wish to inflict on the defendant shall actually be inflicted upon them. What is relevant to our mitzvah here is that the Chkira Udrisha are those things by which their testimony can be declared the testimony of Edim Zeinamin. In other words, if they did not testify when and where exactly they saw the act take place, when other witnesses would come and say, well, you were with us in that place in that time and you could not have seen it, they could always say, well, we didn't say the time. We're speaking about a different time. Therefore, in the questions, we pinpoint the witnesses, not only to ensure that their testimony is proper, but also to ensure that should they not have been there at the time, that other witnesses will be able to come along and completely invalidate their testimony. As the law of the Talmud is, that if it is impossible to completely invalidate the testimony, if it is impossible for Edim Zeinamin to come about, then the testimony is invalid. Specifically, the Rambam lists seven types of questions known as chakiras. In which year did the act take place? In which shvua, this year, in which of the 7 years of the Shemitah cycle was it? In which month did it take place? What day of the month? Which day of the week? What hour of the day? And in which place? All of these questions are known as chakiras. In addition, the Rambam lists different types which are concluded under drisha, and they are the main facts involving the case. For example, if the defendant is accused of idol worship, we ask, what idol was being worshipped, and what kind of worship was being done? Should it be Shabbos? We ask, which malacha, which prohibited act was being done, and how did the person do it? Should he be accused of eating on Yom Kippur? We ask, what was he eating and how much? Should it be a murder? We ask him, what is the murder weapon? These are examples which the Rambam gives. In addition, there are other things we ask, not under the category of his biblical command, but other questions known as bedikas. These are more minor, less essential questions, such as, should it be a murder case? We ask, what kind of ground was it? Or what kind of clothing was the person wearing? Should neither of the witnesses know, nevertheless, their testimony is still valid. However, should they contradict each other? One says a red garment, and the other says a black garment. In that case, their testimony is invalidated, that even though these are not the main questions to be asked, the main questions are chkira udrisha. But nevertheless, should contradiction occur in any of these laws, nevertheless, their testimony is invalid. Now, does this requirement of investigating the testimony and questioning the witnesses at length, does this apply only to capital cases where capital punishment could be inflicted upon a defendant, or is it also in monetary cases, financial disputes? We find a very interesting law in this effect in the Rambam's legal code. By biblical law, both capital cases and financial cases, in both these cases, the witnesses should be questioned with chkira udrisha, with all of this involved and deep questioning. However, the Rambam informs us that in later generations, our sages made a decree, and they declared that no longer would this strict investigation be required of witnesses in financial cases. What is the reason for this? The Rambam quotes the Gemara, which says this is to avoid the door being shut in the face of people who wish to take loans. That if a person takes a loan, we are worried that should a dispute erupt regarding this loan, and the one who loaned the money tries to get back the money which is being denied by the one who is the alleged borrower, and we investigate the witnesses through such involved and confusing questions, eventually we could trip up the witnesses and their testimony would be invalidated. And what would happen? The person in reality borrowed the money, whereas the one that lent will end up losing. As we see was the case in capital cases, that if a court put to death one person in more than 7 years, or according to one version, more than 70 years, they were called a destructive court. And as Rav Akiva said, that if he was ever on a court, he would have prevented anyone from ever being executed. And one of the ways of doing this is through asking such complex questions of the judges, questions of the witnesses. Eventually, you could trip them up and cause them to contradict each other in their testimony. Should the same thing happen in financial cases, the borrower will never end up having to pay off his loan. Once the lenders see that they cannot recover their money in court, they will have the most simple solution. They will stop lending money. Therefore, our sages, upon seeing this happen, or for fear that it would happen, did away with the idea of this involved questioning and cross-examination of the witnesses in order that the loans should be able to be recovered in court, and therefore people will still be able to get loans as they did before. However, if this is the case, and if this is human nature, and this is our suspicion, it seems to be strange. Why then does Torah law equate the two? Why are monetary cases compared with financial cases, if in reality it's impossible to allow such advanced and complex questioning in financial cases? Why does the Torah do things that way? First equate both of them, and then make it so later on the sages will have to make a decree preventing such questioning. The Lubavitcher Rebbe Shlita explains this with an amazing combination of Nigla and Chassidus. The Rebbe explains that there is a basic difference between one's body and one's money. One's money, according to the Torah, is unquestionably one's own, to do with what you want. However, one's body is seen clearly as the possession of Hashem, as God's possession. Therefore, one does not have permission to do with it what one wants. And as the Rebbe explains, it's from a law in Rambam. The Rambam declares that a confession is ineffective in a capital case. If one confesses to having committed a murder, we cannot put the person to death. However, if one confesses his guilt in a monetary case, we believe him. What is the reason for these two things? That Advaz, one of the commentaries on the Rambam, explains that since his body does not belong to him, we cannot accept his testimony. He is testifying about something that does not belong to him. He's testifying about his own body in a capital case, and therefore we cannot believe him. However, his money does belong to him, and when he testifies about his own money, we believe him. Therefore, we see clearly from this law that according to the Torah, one's money belongs more to oneself than does one's body. How do we see that your money belongs to yourself? We can see this also from the law that even in a person's possessions, that in general one is not allowed to have benefit from anything in this world, the Talmud says, until you make a blessing before you eat, and even on thunder you have to make a bracha before you have benefit from it. You have to make a bracha on it anyway. However, when it comes to money, we don't see that you have to make a blessing before you spend money. And the reason is because this, according to Torah, in a way already belongs to you, and therefore you don't have to make a blessing. However, even money, when you think deeper into it, money also belongs to Hashem. On a very basic level, we say that there's a difference, that money belongs to you and your body belongs to Hashem. But deeper, there's nothing in the world that doesn't belong to Hashem. As the story is told of the Chassid of Binyamin Kletzker, who was a businessman, and at the end of the day, when he added up his accounts, he added up all the numbers, he wrote at the bottom of the page, Ein Eid Milvade, that there's nothing aside from Hashem. That he was so penetrated with the understanding that everything in the world was godliness, he wrote at the end of all the numbers, after adding them up, nothing, that there is nothing aside from Hashem. This, however, is a deeper understanding of money. On a lower level, we do differentiate between money and one's body, as we mentioned before from the Radvaz, that money is something which belongs to you. And therefore, since it belongs to you, you're allowed to admit and confess that you owe money. However, your body does not belong to you. It belongs to Hashem. As we discussed previously in the law that you're not allowed to damage yourself, that since your body does not belong to you, it belongs to Hashem, you have no permission to harm it in any way. However, on a deeper level, we do see that money is the same thing as your body, that everything belongs to Hashem. And with this, the Rebbe explained our law over here. As we asked that originally the Torah declared that both monetary cases and capital cases are the same, and therefore we question the witnesses equally by both. However, later on, we said in order to prevent the people from withholding loans, we differentiate between money and capital cases. And now we can understand. At a previous level, after the Torah was given, when the Jews were on a high spiritual level, they had the deep realization that even their money belonged to Hashem. And since they realized their money belonged to Hashem, why should they close the door in the face of the lender? How could they withhold money and not give it to the borrower for fear he wouldn't give it back? They were penetrated with an understanding that the money was not theirs to begin with. And since they had that same understanding that just like their body belonged to Hashem, so too their money belonged to Hashem, we do not differentiate between monetary laws and capital cases, since they understood that everything belonged to Hashem. However, later on, as there was a decline in the Jewish people, as the Alter Rebbe explains in Lakutei Torah, that the reason that so many decrees have been added on through the ages is because of the decline spiritually of the generations, we need more decrees to keep us in line with the Torah. So as the generations declined, people lost this feeling that their money belonged to Hashem and they felt that it belonged to them. And therefore there was a worry people would stop loaning, and therefore they stopped this complex and detailed questioning of the witnesses. Thank you for tuning in to the daily portion of Sefer HaMitzvahs. For more information or to sponsor one of the shiurim, contact Sichas in English at 718-778-5436. And please join us again tomorrow.